Now, can I welcome you all here tonight? It's good of you to come out on such a terrible night. It's not a terrible night, it's actually a good night, but the weather's just not what you'd like it to be. But it's good of you to come out, it's good of you to leave the far side, and it's good of you to switch the box off and just come out and have a bit of a chat and enjoy fellowship and enjoy being together. Please, come on in. Good to see you, Joyce, Richard, come on in. You're very, very welcome, and it's lovely to have the Archbishop with us, lovely to have the Archdeacon with us. And we're looking forward to thinking about, over these next couple of weeks, being a Christian in a secular society. Being a Christian in a secular society. And I think we can see from all the different places we have come from, it doesn't matter. The community we live in and the world we live in today is exactly the same, in that people are changing and secularism is growing. And that's the world and the society that you and I live in today. So it'll be very, very interesting to hear what the Archbishop has to say as he leads us this week and next week. We're going to begin, and I'm hoping Jonathan's going to put a hymn up on the screen. This is one of the modern Townsend Getty hymns. My heart is filled with thankfulness, and it'll be coming up in just a wee minute. Lovely. Okay. We stand to sing.
Let us pray. As we come together this evening to think of our Christian witness in this ever more secular world, so we give thanks to God for those who first helped us to understand what the Christian faith was all about. Those who first helped us to know God's love, and those who first took the risk of sharing their own faith by what they did or said. We thank God for them. Lord, in your mercy. And as we give thanks for those who shared their faith with us, so we pray that we too might share our faith in word and deed in the world today. We remember those who have a special gift for making the gospel relevant and attractive. We pray for those who have a special way of living that draws others to Christ. And we give thanks to God for the many opportunities that come our own ways every day to show his love. Lord, in your mercy. And we acknowledge before God our own diffidence in sometimes sharing our faith, the fear of embarrassment, of seeming manipulative, of losing the trust of friends. So we pray instead, Lord, give to us hearts full of love and lives centered on Jesus Christ, so that our words and actions are all of a piece and always Christian. So may we find ourselves naturally talking of Christian things or talking of other things Christianly. In the way we respond to stories in the news, in the way we handle issues in the workplace, in the way we defend the weak, in the way we care for the wounded. At all times, may we speak of you and act for you with courtesy and integrity. We ask it for your name's sake. Amen.
We're going to turn to the Word of God for our Bible reading. And again, Jonathan very kindly has put it up on the screen for us. We're going to turn to Acts chapter 17, and we're going to read from verse 16. Acts 17, reading from verse 16. While Paul was waiting for them in Athens, he was greatly distressed to see that the city was full of idols. So he reasoned in the synagogue with both Jews and God-fearing Greeks, as well as in the marketplace day by day, with those who happened to be there. A group of Epicurean and Stoic philosophers began to debate with him. Some of them asked, "What is this babbler trying to say?" Others remarked, "He seems to be advocating foreign gods." They said this because Paul was preaching the good news about Jesus and the resurrection. Then they took him and brought him to a meeting of the Areopagus, where they said to him, "May we know what this new teaching is you are presenting? You are bringing some strange ideas to our ears, and we would like to know what they mean." All the Athenians and the foreigners who lived there spent their time doing nothing but talking about and listening to the latest ideas. Paul then stood up in the meeting of the Areopagus and said, "People of Athens, I see that in every way you are very religious. For as I walked around and looked carefully at your objects of worship, I even found an altar with the inscription, 'To an unknown God.' So you are ignorant of the very thing you worship, and that is what I am going to proclaim to you. The God who made the world and everything in it is the Lord of heaven and earth, and does not live in temples built by human hands. And he is not served by human hands, as if he needed anything. Rather, he himself gives everyone life and breath and everything else. From one man he made all the nations, that they should inhabit the whole earth. And he marked out their appointed times in history and the boundaries of their lands. God did this so that they would seek him and perhaps reach out for him and find him, though he is not far from any one of us. For in him we live and move and have our being. And some of your own poets have said, we are his offspring. Therefore, since we are God's offspring, we should not think that the divine being is like gold or silver or stone, an image made by human design and skill. In the past, God overlooked such ignorance, but now he commands all people everywhere to repent. For he has set a day when he will judge the world with justice by the man he has appointed. He has given proof of this to everyone by raising him from the dead. When they heard about the resurrection of the dead, some of them sneered, but others said, we want to hear you again on this subject. At that, Paul left the council. Some of the people became followers of Paul and believed. Among them was Dionysus, a member of Areopagus, also a woman named Damaris, and a number of others. Here ends our reading.
Well, good evening, everybody. And first of all, like Canon Hughes, may I thank you for coming out this evening. Not the most pleasant of evenings, but thank you so much for being here. And again, thank you to Muller Brack, as always, for your hospitality for these meetings. I think what we're talking about tonight is in some ways one of the most important things we could ever think about. You probably remember from the Hebrew scriptures a point where David and his troops are gathering at Hebron, and it's said of the men of Issachar that they knew the times, they understood the times. In other words, they understood the world in which they were living. And it seems to me for us, if we are serious about what mission is, we have to be very clear about the surrounding world, the world in which we are living, rather than the world that we can so easily construct for ourselves and live within that world. And so, if we are serious about mission, we need to be utterly realistic and quite steely-eyed about the society, the world in which we live, not to condemn it, but simply to understand it so that our mission may actually be to outside rather than just among ourselves. You see, if we're not clear on where our mission is, well then we can just simply regard mission as shouting louder. And shouting louder in the society in which we live is not going to convince people. And even a parish perhaps having a mission, and I'm not decrying parish missions, but very often we can be talking to like-minded people. We can be actually simply encouraging the existing members of the church rather than actually reaching out and shouting louder about mission to those who are of our own is not actually what mission is meant to be. So thinking about the world in which we live, increasingly a secular world, let's look first briefly at what we really mean by the word secular. Well, I have to say at the beginning, it's a word that has changed meaning from its origins. In classical Latin, the word seculum was just a period of time. Normally, it was regarded as being the average lifetime. And when, at the end of the Gloria, glory be to the Father and to the Son, we use the phrase, world without end, amen, the Latin of that was a simple Latin phrase, secula seculorum, in secula seculorum, which simply means the age of ages. It doesn't really mean world without end, but it means age of ages. It's us out of, if you like, age, time as we know it. It is that which creates a new understanding of what it is to be within time and actually carries us out of it. So the word secular originally had no ominous meaning for Christians, the word seculum, but as time has gone on, it has of course changed its meaning. And for many, many centuries, whether one was a Christian or not, the idea that what was in the world was somehow distinct from that which was also outside the world would have made very little sense indeed. But what really changed everything for Western society was what we call the European Enlightenment. It began in the 17th century and carried on into the 18th century in its original form, and it began with the philosophers Descartes and Locke. And what it was doing was essentially saying that at the center of all our consideration is the human, the person, the individual. That's where we start our exploration from. The first of the Enlightenment philosophers were not godless. They believed in God. They were probably more believers in God than Orthodox Christians. But nevertheless, they weren't trying to remove God altogether. But what they were doing, consciously and unconsciously, was separating the world from the bigger context of, in fact, a wider, bigger sense of what existence was. And of course, what they also managed to do then was to, and much of it was to our benefit, was to send great leaps forward in science. And I remember hearing Tom Wright, the English theologian, once saying, we have a lot to thank the philosopher for, and we have a lot to thank the Enlightenment for. We would probably have all died at the age of about 40 or 50 had it not been for the Enlightenment and for the huge advances in medical science. The Enlightenment has done a great deal for our quality of life, but what it did do was take the world in which we live out of the much bigger context of time and eternity, of human and divine. They were separated now for the first time. And as time has gone on and the generations have gone on, today what we mean by secularization and a secularized society, secularization is really that process which isolates religion from the affairs of this world, so that religion is now for many people simply a private matter. It's a compartment within life, rather than actually being something which, if you like, fills all of life. And that new development, and it is a new development really of the last few centuries, is, say, begins with the European Enlightenment, but in fact it is something which is almost unknown in other parts of the world, which has not been so affected by this particular Western idea of reason as the heart of everything and science as the final end of everything. Now, I think we can divide quite easily into two kinds of secularization, and indeed the headings for these two evenings suggest two kinds of secularization. As I was writing the papers, I discovered, in fact, that there's a lot of overlap between them. I'm not going to keep repeating next week what I'm saying this week, but there is, nevertheless, a lot of overlap between what we might call soft secularization and hard secularization. Now, I'm not talking about soft Brexit and hard Brexit. We're talking about soft secularization and hard secularization. There may actually be some similarities, but that's neither here nor there. But I suppose if I wanted to describe briefly the difference between the two, I'd say that soft secularization is very much something we would associate with mainland Britain. It is a process that in many ways has gone on from probably the First World War in a major way, when so much disrupted the life of people in Britain. And soft secularization just saw a gradual ebbing away of religious observance, of involvement in church, and it has been a very, very slow process. But there's no antagonism about it. At times there's even a wistfulness of people that actually faith and religion are no longer at the center of the life of the country, and indeed of individual people's lives either. And some of you may know a poem from the 19th century, but it actually prefigures a great deal of what I'm talking about with soft secularization, by Matthew Arnold called Dover Beach, where obviously Matthew Arnold sees the tide going out, and he connects this with how faith is simply going out like the tide. And say, I'll just read you a few lines of it, but to say, think of the tide going out. The sea of faith was once too at the full, and round earth's shore lay like the folds of a bright girdle furled. But now I only hear its melancholy, long, withdrawing roar, retreating to the breath of the night wind down the vast edges drear and naked shingles of the world. The idea, sadly, wistfully, faith is kind of going out like the tide. And that, I think, is very much something characteristic of, as I say, the way that secularization is experienced on our neighboring island. If I talk about hard secularization, it is something far more brutal, it is far more intentional, it is not accidental, there's nothing vague about it. Hard secularization, which I'll be talking much more about next week, is actually where there is a determined effort by people, almost a propagandist effort by people, to get religion out of public consciousness, to get religion off the public stage, and to present religion as something downright dangerous and downright damaging to people. Now, where, and it is totally counterintuitively as someone who grew up in the Republic of Ireland, but where we're actually seeing that most strongly near here is actually in the South. It's due for a number of reasons, and I'll talk a little bit more about that, but actually there is a sense in which the Republic of Ireland is showing a very hard-edged secularization in a way that would never have been expected 30, 40, 50 years ago. And I was talking this morning to the clergy of Derry on a fairly related subject, and one of the clergy from Derry Diocese was saying he'd been a curate in Dublin, and he said he thinks the only clergyman of almost any denomination who felt they had to walk around Dublin city wearing a clerical collar because they would be mocked and jeered and even have insults thrown at them for wearing a clerical collar, certainly in some parts of the city of Dublin. I mean, think of 40, 50 years ago, that would have been inconceivable. So there is a hard secularization, not very far from here. And as I know the clergy around here have heard me say from time to time, one of the reasons I like clergy to wear their clerical collars, and we have two prime examples here on the front row, is they should feel that this is actually a privilege and that they have neighbors and friends only 100 miles away who cannot do that because of the sheer danger at times of being mocked or being jeered at. And far from being a mark of being one of the people, it is in some ways a mark of cowardice not to wear one's collar in difficult and dangerous places. And so don't underestimate how there is a hard secularization not very far away from here. I know we have a couple of people from the Republic of Ireland here who could probably say this is exactly what is being faced in the South. Northern Ireland is in a way a bit of each. Yes, I think if we take things seriously, yes, we can see there is a drawing away from church observance, from religious observance. I think that in many ways it has perhaps shown a different approach than other parts, because I think that the tragedies of violence over so long meant that people's sense of identity was so much more bound up with their communities, their faith communities, and in many ways this was part of an identity. And it's not suggesting the faith wasn't real, but it does mean that very often the place of faith, the place of the church, was in fact a place also of identity as well. And so the whole movement, if you like, of secularization has probably been rather slower here. But I think it is at the diocesan synod that Canon Hughes was saying that there are actually now positive, serious moves to get religion out of schools, even here in Northern Ireland. So let's be under no misapprehension that secularization has somehow bypassed the society in which we live. But to give some ideas of the actual extent of it, the Church of England does a census every year with various statistics. And I think the one that I found most frightening in their most recent figures, which came out just a couple of weeks ago, of 2015, and the Church of England is well aware of what is happening, was that over the whole of 2015, there were 16,000 confirmations in the entire Church of England. Now, 16,000 sounds like a lot, but the entire Church of England. And I don't see this with any sense of self-satisfaction for us, but there were some big, big dioceses in big cities like Birmingham that had a couple of hundred people confirmed in an entire year. I don't know what our figures are here, but I suspect they're either there or more than that for a diocese merely the size of Armagh. So that is the way that secularization can become part of a fact of life. I say it with no satisfaction. A couple of years ago when we did our own census, it was calculated that only 15% of those who self-identify as Church of Ireland were in church on a given Sunday in November, and it was done over three Sundays. Now, we don't know if people were there one Sunday, not the next, and there another Sunday, but not, we don't know. But at the same time, 15%, and I think here it was something around 20%, but let's face it, we have nothing to feel complacent about when a mere handful of those who would self-identify as being part of the Church of Ireland will be in church on a given Sunday. Now, let me concentrate now really on what I'm going to call soft secularization. I've suggested the causes can probably be found in developments in modern society. There is no point in people saying, oh, it's because people don't bring their children to church. There's no point in saying it's because church isn't exciting enough. There's no point in saying it's their fault they don't put on a good enough show in church, or it's their fault they don't say their prayers with their children every night. We're talking about societal changes that are going to affect every part of our churches. I've suggested that the origins can be found in the Enlightenment. Not entirely a bad thing, the Enlightenment, but nevertheless damaging. And I think it was that William Temple, the great Archbishop of Canterbury, who said that the most disastrous moment for modern Europe was the day that Descartes said, "I think, therefore I am," because actually what it did was bring all existence back to my existence. And I think that really has been part of what has created a culture today which is all about individualism. Me as the individual. Because from that stems, first of all, a sense of materialism, that what is important is my comfort, what is important is my interests, what is important is how I am finding this. That then leads to a consumerism that says, do I want this? Wouldn't I like this? And of course, as sure as night follows day, you get then an approach to church and church going that is also consumerist. And people become utterly casual about church, being engaged with church, being part of a church worshipping community. And it becomes much more a matter of, well, does it suit me to go to church today? Will I really get much out of it? Is it really worth my while? And even in some days, you know, do we really need to pay for that idiot who we have as our rector? Because actually, are we getting value for money out of him or her? Now, I'm being facetious, I know. But how facetious am I being? It's no longer about God. It's no longer about our duty to worship God who created us and to be thankful to God for all that he's given us. It has now become a matter of, well, does it suit me? And that is one of the huge changes that many of us would have seen through years and decades of ministry. When I was first ordained in a nearby diocese, normally one would have said there was a fair cohort of people that you could almost wait to start the service until they actually arrived in church. They were simply there, and if they weren't there, you knew they were either ill or they were away on holiday. I still found that the situation in West Cork 20 years later, that there was a large cohort, maybe 50% of those I knew of as parishioners, who would have been in church Sunday by Sunday by Sunday, not because they weren't thinking about it, not because it was something that, if you like, they felt they had to do to express their identity. It was something they did because it was part of a rhythm of life. It was part of what they were. Now, I'm not being critical of those, whether here or elsewhere, who have changed that, but if you asked most clergy who have been around the blocks for a long time, they would say that is the biggest change in our generation, is people who are churchgoers are no longer people that you can almost wait to start the service until they arrive. They will be there. They'll be there every second week, every third week, every fourth week, now and then. But the sense of an absolute cohort of people who will not miss unless there is very, very good reason is something that's changed. Now, I'm not saying that as it would be utterly wrong to say it as criticism. I'm saying it as fact. And much of it is the secularizing atmosphere that is all around us and is infecting and affecting even good, godly Christians as well, that we have become consumerist in the way we approach our faith, rather than the sense that this is something that, as the Eucharistic prayer or the preface in the old communion service said, it is our duty, it is our bounden duty, that at all times and in all places, our bounden duty. Not, well, when it suits us, we can give thanks and praise and express our need of God. So that has been the huge change, and I'm not laboring it for the sake of laboring it, but it is what is actually happening. And I think people are not even really noticing that their attitude to faith has changed. A few weeks ago, I was at a funeral of the mother of a friend of mine, and it was utterly fascinating because the family, part of the family that I would know best, would be very much people of belief, people of faith. And interestingly enough, at the funeral and chatting afterwards, they were the ones who were kind of saying, look, we don't know what the next life is like. We cannot know. But because we trust in God, we believe God is a God of love, we do not need to fear it. We know that it is there. We know that God is holding us in his hands, and that the next life, although we can't describe it, is nevertheless something that we need never fear, because we believe in a God of love. We believe in a God that is there for us. They were talking, if you like, in quite abstract terms, but nevertheless terms of huge faith. It was actually another side of the family who have virtually no church connection, who were coming out with sentimental mush, like, oh, I'm sure her husband is looking over at us now here at what we're doing here, and I'm sure he's going to welcome her into heaven and say, well, it took you long enough to get here. I mean, it was extraordinary, the contrast between faithful people who weren't going to speculate about the nature of the next world because they had faith and they trust, and other people who were talking, as I say, absolute sentimental nonsense about people hanging over balconies and looking at us and welcoming other people there. You know, let us understand that faith is about trust. It's not about sentimentality. It's not about wish fulfillment. It is about trust in the living God and nothing less. But what has happened is that now there is a new movement, sometimes called New Atheism and sometimes called Atheism 2. There is a very good philosopher, but I don't like him, called Alain de Botton, who is a Swiss-English philosopher. And he has coined the phrase of Atheism 2.0. You know the way that if you have a computer, every time it goes up and up, what the actual, what do they call them, operating systems, keep going up with another digit. And he calls this Atheism 2. And what Alain de Botton is saying is that, you know, the content of faith is just untrue. There's no truth in it. But actually, it's rather nice, isn't it? And so, yes, let's enjoy singing Christmas carols. And, you know, let's enjoy going to places of worship. And let's enjoy the kind of feel-good factor about religion. But let's not imagine that there's any reality behind it. Now, to me, this is almost the most dangerous of all developments, that people will want the externals of religion, but they actually will say, yes, I love the carol services. I go every year to carol services. And yes, harvests are beautiful, aren't they? And yes, it's really good to see these lovely churches. But of course, there's no reality behind it. It's not about truth. And I think that as this, again, is probably far more dangerous than the Richard Dawkins of this world who are savagely attacking, because at least you know what you're dealing with there, with this new soft atheism, which admires the feel-good aspects of religion, but doesn't want to take it seriously, I think is probably doing far, far more damage by making a museum out of faith. I'm now going to, having perhaps talked about some of the causes, what I'd like to do for a few minutes now is to perhaps look at the things perhaps we should try and avoid doing, and perhaps some of the ways you and I as Christians should try and witness in a secularized society. And all I want to say is to say this is not just about clergy doing it for you. When I came to Armagh Diocese nearly 4 years ago, I said, my greatest hope for the diocese is that we could produce a community of people where every Christian disciple was a front-line evangelist. In other words, they were not saying, oh, well, it's up to other people to explain to you about the faith. It's up to other people, if you like, to be able to articulate the faith. No, this is the task of everyone here, that we have to be able to defend the faith, to articulate the faith, and indeed to propagate the faith, to make people aware that we are not just Christians by accident. We are Christians with a purpose. One of the great phrases being used at the Anglican Consultative Council, the conference I was at in Africa, was what was called intentional discipleship. At first of all, I thought, well, what on earth does that mean? Is that the opposite of accidental discipleship? But actually, it's a very useful phrase. It means being a disciple with intention, rather than simply, if you like, casually. Intentional disciples, on purpose, doing something and taking action. So I want to talk for a couple of minutes about maybe the things we need to avoid doing. And I've talked about these many times in the past and even written about them, but you have probably not read what I have written and you've probably not heard me say it. I'm going to say it again. So the first thing is there are three kind of ways in which we can be Christians, and we have an awful habit of being Christians in this land, but we really need to avoid. And the first is, the first image is that of the ghetto. Now, a ghetto is actually, we tend to think of it as being a place where people are herded together and are endangered. We think of the Jewish ghetto in Warsaw. We think of ghettos as being places of danger for the inhabitants, but actually they're not. Ghettos are simply places that are contained with walls around them and where people can live perfectly safely and perfectly happily, but they are separated from the world around. This is, if you like, their enclave. We might call it their bunker if we wanted to do, but they're slightly larger than a bunker. It is a ghetto. And it is very, very easy for the Christian church to decide that its best hope of survival is to be a very respectable and very comfortable ghetto. We can go on doing churchy things, we can go on holding vestry meetings and synods and all kinds of exciting things, and nobody outside the ghetto will give a hang. We can go on doing it for generation after generation after generation, and we will survive in our comfortable ghetto. We will be having no influence on the world outside, and the world outside will be having no influence on us. Fine and dandy, except it's not actually what we're put on earth to be and to do. But the ghetto mentality, it's so, so easy to think that it's all about survival, all about simply being in a place that is safe, being in a place that is comfortable, being in a place where we can go on living without contact with all these awful people outside who might contaminate us. And make no mistake, I think in the Church of Ireland we do have to face that temptation to be a ghetto. So that, yes, we do other stuff outside, but we retreat into our ghetto on Sundays, and that is simply where we can live comfortably. I think the second thing we need to avoid doing, and also very tempting to do, and there's a long historical pedigree for it, is to just see that our relationship with the world is that of what would have been called as a noun, a scold. We spend our entire lives scolding the world for not being like us. And we can do this. It's great fun if you just simply assume that everything in the world around us is wrong because we happen to be right, and therefore we can be, as a church, a constant scold. Now, that is actually not what Christ was in his discipleship. He did not go round scolding people relentlessly. And yet it is so easy for our identity to be that which is shaking our fist at everything and anything in the society around us. Again, it is utterly enjoyable and utterly counterproductive and utterly unchristian, because that is not the way of Christ, to simply spend our lives shaking our fist at everything that is going on in the world around us. Yes, there are times, and I'll be talking about it, there are times when we do have to stand against the world, and I'll talk about some of the ways in which we do. But it is not actually a Christ-like attitude to simply spend our time scolding those who are not of us. I think the third thing, and this probably is the greatest temptation for a different part of the church, is to be a chameleon. Now, I'm not really a naturalist, but a chameleon, as I understand it, can manage to change its colour quite cleverly so that it kind of merges into the world around it and what's going on around it. And this way it avoids getting killed rather more early than it might otherwise be, by simply changing its colour in order to be invisible. And if we as Christians want to be the chameleons of society, so that whatever society is saying is good, and whatever society says is cool and attractive, well, we somehow will kind of merge into that. Yes, we'll survive, but it will be at the cost of an utter faithfulness and betrayal of what Christianity is about. But be under no misapprehension, my friends. We in our Church of Ireland have faced those different ways of approaching life again and again and again, whether as the ghetto, or as the scold, or as the chameleon. And none of those have any biblical authority whatsoever. So if I say what not to do, let's look at ways we can look at the world around us, because this is really what we're here for. A wonderful book was written about 60 years ago called Christ and Culture. It was written by an American theologian by the name of Richard Niebuhr. And what Richard Niebuhr did was said, there are different ways of looking at the place of Christ in the culture around. And we can translate this as meaning the place of the church in society around. And Niebuhr went through five of these, and I will be talking a bit more again next week, just to make sure you all come back. But one of the things, the first thing that Niebuhr talked about was what he called Christ against culture. Now, this would have been very, very much a strand in some Christian thinking, and rather like the scold, that Christ is there confronting culture all the time, confronting the surrounding world, confronting the ideas that are there. We would see it in the writings probably of Tolstoy. We would see it today in a much more gentle way in the Amish people in America, who simply separate themselves from culture and will not be part of modern culture. They simply keep themselves separated from the culture around them. So this would be Christ against culture. The opposite of that is what is called, and what Niebuhr calls, the Christ of culture. And this is entirely the opposite. There is no tension between Christ and culture. And again, there would be those through Christian history who would have said, but God is the Lord of the church. He's also the Lord of culture. And I think we have to learn sometimes that, yes, we have to, at times, listen to the world around us. Now, sometimes we have to confront surrounding culture. And just to give an example of this in my own kind of thinking, I'm not conservative about all things, but a couple of ethical matters about which I am extraordinarily conservative would be end-of-life issues and beginning-of-life issues. I mean, I am passionately, if you like, conservative about both of those, both the idea of euthanasia and the end of life and the idea of easy abortion. I'm, as I say, it's a thing about which I feel extraordinarily passionately for reasons that we won't go into here, but I do feel very passionately and I believe that I'm doing it for Christian reasons. Now, this would be an example for me of where one has to stand against surrounding culture. Because in a consumerist culture, in a culture where, if you like, people are now finding that life is for them their own possession, well then, obviously, it follows from this, that if it's a possession, and if my body is my body, and if even an unborn fetus is mine, and if the end of life is for me to decide, well then clearly, culture will lead people to believing that this is something which is can be regarded as normality. Now, I'm sure in this room there are people who disagree with me on this. I'm not going to lie awake worrying about it, but I would simply say, but this is an issue on which I, for one, would feel very strongly and very passionately. I hope not without compassion, but certainly also passionately. Now, this might be an example of where it might be the task of the church to stand against culture. On the other hand, there are times when culture has brought us to a realization of what the implications of the gospel are. Sometimes the church can be the last of people to realize just what the implications of the gospel actually are. And it's sad to say that it was not the church, it was a couple of individuals certainly, it was not the church as the church which ended slavery in Western Europe. And even sadder to relate, that when the House of Lords debated it in Britain in the early 19th century, apparently the House of Bishops, to a man, voted against the abolition of slavery because they said, well, it was biblical, and therefore they couldn't vote against it. So at times it can actually be a surrounding culture that helps us as Christians to see what the implications of the gospel were all the time. So we should never say we don't have to listen to the world around us. But what we do have to do is have that independence of thought, that rootedness in the gospel, whereby we can discern where we have to stand against the prevailing culture and where at times we have to listen to the prevailing culture, which may be pointing us towards implications of the gospel that perhaps we hadn't grasped because they are not laid out in black and white in the scriptures. And so it's that sensitivity to the surrounding world that we have to have. It is not enough just to simply, say, be the ghetto, shut ourselves up from it, or to be the chameleon and go along with anything that culture says. We have to have the strength of mind, the independence of mind, and the confident rootedness in our own sense of God's kingdom to be able to decide which is which. When is it Christ against culture, and when is it to be the Christ that is actually of culture? Not easy to do. I think also, and this is where we had the gospel or the reading, should I say, from the Acts of the Apostles, the most important thing I think you and I have to remember is where we start when we are dealing with those who are not part of faith. The wonderful story of the speech, the sermon, the defense on the Areopagus in Athens tells us really everything about what mission means in a secularized world. Now just think of Athens for a while. It was the hub of civilization in many ways, far more than Rome. It was a hub of civilization. It was the birthplace of philosophy, the birthplace of ideas. People had their own different ideas. And what does Paul do? He doesn't start on the Areopagus by telling people his story. He actually goes to where they are, where they are thinking, what their needs are, what their ideas are, and then draws that into his own understanding of the resurrection and of Christ. And it's interesting that the two groups of people mentioned are the Epicureans and the Stoics. And in fact, they wouldn't call themselves Epicureans and Stoics. They probably couldn't even spell it. But actually, there are plenty of Epicureans and Stoics around. The Epicureans, essentially, if I summarize it, and I'm sure the dean or someone else will tell me if I get it wrong, essentially, the Epicureans were about sort of more or less eat, drink, and be merry, for tomorrow we die. In other words, there is very little purpose here. Let's enjoy life while we have it. I think that's more or less it, isn't it, for the Epicureans? It's more or less the Epicureans. It was certainly an idea of enjoyment of what was here while we had it. The Stoics was, well, we can't do anything about it, so let's put up with it as it is. So actually, there are Epicureans and Stoics around at the moment as well. They simply don't call themselves that. There are those groups of people. And what does Paul do? He starts where they are. He doesn't start where he is. And so often, our idea of mission is that we will start where we are. And as I said, we will think that by simply shouting our own slogans, and to people outside, they can only hear them as slogans, then in fact we have lost them before we even start. Because people very often have actually either become inoculated against religious, churchy language, or they don't understand it in the first place. And to assume that they will understand our language, our way of speaking, our way of understanding the gospel is actually a very, very major failure on our part. People, as I say, don't understand the language of faith. We have to start where they are, not where we are. So if we want to know, well, where are people? What do people today, what are they looking for in life that we can, if you like, relate to them in that place? I'd suggest a few things. First of all, I think people lack any realization that they are loved, that they're loved by God, that they can be loved by us. Isolated, alone, individualists. And we will achieve nothing by simply starting by telling people that they are sinful. They won't even begin to understand what we are talking about. If we tell people that they are loved, loved unconditionally by God, loved by God as much as we are or anybody else is, and that is at the very heart of the gospel, then maybe we have something to which people long and for which people want, to know that they are loved, to know that they matter, to know that they actually are not alone, that there are people around them, that there is a God who made them in his own image and likeness, and who loves them as if they were the only person ever created. Now, we don't start there, but if we're actually asking, what are people looking for in life? What are people longing for in life? Then I believe that actually the realization that they're loved can actually be at the very beginning of what they want, what they need. And following from this, the actual truth that they belong. They belong to us. They belong to the church. We don't make the rules. We don't say, well, you can't come in here because you have to sign up to this, this, and this before you can belong. Christ didn't make those stipulations. Who did he find himself dining with? The sinners, the outcasts, the people that nobody else would go near. And we then have the temerity to say, well, we've got a long list of instructions before you really ought to feel you can belong here. No, that is not the gospel. If you read the ministry of Jesus Christ, what you find is that he is always to be found in the places where people thought he oughtn't to be. And if our sense of a church is a place where anyone, anyone can feel, I don't belong here, then is it any wonder that secularization is making such inroads into the life of our society? Again, I think we have to be very much aware that people need to understand that there are really two alternatives. There is either a purpose and a meaning in life, or there is no purpose and no meaning. It's not that in Christianity we create the meaning, we create the purpose. But in a way, it is an either-or. Either we can say, look, you can have a purpose in life, you can have a meaning in life, if you actually wish to think about it and wish to somehow engage with that which gives you purpose and gives you meaning. But if you don't, then there is no purpose. There is no meaning. And get on with it. Be an Epicurean. Be a Stoic in that case, if you actually think there is no intrinsic purpose in your life. But above all, I think what people want to do and people long to do is to somehow connect with otherness. A few years ago, I was at a conference in Scotland with the Irish, Welsh, and Scottish bishops. And we were told at a lecture that in one of the medium-sized Scottish cities at a weekend a few weeks before that, more people had gone to a psychic fair than were in all the churches in that city. So don't be under any illusion that if people do not find some connectedness with the spiritual, do not find some connectedness with God, do not find some connectedness with otherness than themselves, that they won't find it somewhere. Yes, they will. But it'll be our fault if they find it in the strangest and most bizarre and most dangerous of places. A psychic fair that had more people at it than all the churches in one medium-sized city does say it all about people's longing for finding something to which they can belong, something to which they can relate, and something which takes them out of themselves into the realm of the spiritual, for us, the realm of God. And one of the most fascinating things is that the Benedictine monastery in Ross Trevor, which some of you will know, one of the most interesting things about it is that not only do they have hordes of young people going to it, but the bulk of people that actually go to the Ross Trevor monastery, run by the Benedictines, are Protestant young people who are going there because that is what they are looking for. They're not looking for the particular liturgies, but they're looking for that sense of connection with otherness. And through my connections with the Orthodox, Greece, Cyprus, monasteries are being built at a huge rate because there are people who are trying to find a spirituality which they do not have within themselves. So never, ever, ever believe that people have become less spiritual. The challenge to us is, are they finding with us, with the kind of communities we are, a kind of sense of connecting with the God who created them, the God who loves them? And in many ways, some of the secularization about which we speak is something that we have created as well, because in a sense we have clearly failed. If people would sooner go to a psychic fair or sooner go elsewhere than to find their connectedness with God, with us. And it is not excitement they're looking for. It is not performance they're looking for. It is not all whistles and bells they're looking for. It is the sense of the sacred, the sense that they matter, the sense there is purpose, the sense there is meaning, the sense that there is indeed a connection with God and the God and Father of our Lord Jesus Christ. Next week, I'm going to talk a little bit more and indeed expand on what I'm talking about tonight, about other ways in which our mission can actually be a mission to those who perhaps have given up on us, those who reject what we are, those who resent what we are. But can I just go back to where, in fact, I started and say that if we are taking mission seriously, then it can only be when we are looking outwards. We are not simply trying to energize and re-enthuse our own people. Rather, we are encouraging them to face outwards rather than to face inwards. And say, for every Christian to be a frontline evangelist, whether it is in the workplace, as the Archdeacon was saying in the prayers, whether it is in the home, and whether it is at the dinner party, and whether it is somewhere the Archdeacon wouldn't even dream of thinking about, whether it is in the pub or anywhere else, that this will be the place where actually the conversation becomes a conversation where people are and a conversation about God, a conversation about love, a conversation about purpose, because those are the things that people are still striving for, even in the middle of a secularized world. And when you are all frontline evangelists, as you are, this indeed is what your purpose is to be in life. Thank you very much indeed. As I said, next week I want to look more at both the origins but also at the ways we approach those who are antagonistic, who are hard secularists rather than the soft secularists who have simply drifted away from faith. But just before I ask for questions or comments, and I do hope you will give me some comments, because I'm learning as well. I don't have all the answers, and if you can help me with some of these, so much the better. But just before we do this, I want just to perhaps give us hope. And it is hope in a strange place. Some of you will have heard of the English poet Philip Larkin, and there's a wonderful poem of Larkin's. Now, Larkin was a non-believer, but he loved visiting churches. And churches were a place that had a fascination for him. Now, this is not new atheism, but listen to what Larkin said about visiting a church, because it does show this kind of longing inside many, many people for actually meaning and for purpose. And this is a poem of Larkin's. I'm only going to read a bit of it, called Church Going. It pleases me to stand in silence here. A serious house on serious earth it is, in whose blent air all our compulsions meet, are recognized, and robed as destinies. And that much never can be obsolete, since someone will forever be surprising a hunger in himself to be more serious, and gravitating with it to this ground. The hunger to be more serious, bringing people to even an empty church. Now, any good ideas for me, any comments that I should be writing down? We have a few minutes of this. I don't want to keep you out too late, given the night that's in it, but any comments anyone would like to help me with? You're all either stunned. Oh, sorry, yes, the dean is going to help me at this stage.
Forgive me, Archbishop. Can I just mention three things that came as you were speaking, and thank you so much for wonderfully put together paper. The chameleon surely is the church at Laodicea, neither hot nor cold. Yeah. I remember that when I go to Dublin on the train, just before it pulls into Connolly, houses on the left-hand side, they're poor houses, but there's a gated community among them. Is that the metaphor for our church? Yeah. And if, forgive me for saying this, but I thought your analysis of the societal forces of secularization was one of the best definitions of the power of sin in St. Paul's concept that I've ever heard. Thank you.
From the world of hard secularization, Drogheda.
May I tell you a story about hard secularization? Last November, the local hospital in Drogheda always runs a service for parents who have lost babies or young people. And they had suddenly discovered that I was part of the chaplaincy team, and they asked me to come along and perhaps do that service. So I was delighted. And when I arrived, I was handed a sheet. This we saw at another's hospital, and it was wonderful. So there was a song to begin that I didn't know, but you wouldn't be surprised at that. And then there was a poem that I didn't know. And then there was a song that I'd never heard of. And then there was a poem. And it went on right through. And there wasn't one mention of God. And they wanted me, with my dog collar, to be part of it. And I don't usually complain about things unless it's really serious, because I'm a big wuss and a coward. But I said to them, if you have me, we've got to have some mention of God. And they said, right, you do it. And at the end of it, nearly the whole congregation thanked me. So 3 or 4 people wanted to make this celebration of lost babies' lives. They wanted to make it a secular thing. But the congregation at large, and there were about 300 to 400 there, did not.
On a similar basis, and this is not just simply to remind us who are based in Northern Ireland how lucky we are, but interestingly enough, many of you know St. James's Hospital in Dublin, a huge hospital, and a few years ago, the hospital authorities decided that not to have a crib, which had always been part of the decoration of Christmas, that they couldn't have a crib in the front hall as you walk into St. James's Hospital because it would be offensive to those of other religions. And I was fascinated. I know one of the chaplains of St. James's Hospital, and he said, interestingly enough, the Muslim shopkeeper across the way was absolutely furious. He said, how on earth dare they say that we are the reason they don't want a crib? Of course, in a Christian country, you should be expected to have the symbols of your faith in a hospital where people are Christians. And again, very often it is political correctness, supposedly, that we don't offend Jews and Muslims and Hindus and Buddhists, who are probably utterly unoffended by the fact that Christian symbols are visible. But in fact, it is, if you like, a cloaking of sheer raw secularization that pretends this is so as not to offend those of other faiths. And as I say, any good Muslim and good Jew is not going to be offended by Christian symbols any more than we would dare to be offended in another country if there were symbols of Islam, or if we were in Israel, would we be offended by anything that we saw there that was a part of Jewishness. So there's, as I say, a very insidious way of trying to suggest that this is really just in the interests of good neighborliness and not offending those of other faiths. The only people it is offending are those who are of no faith and wish there to be no faith visible anywhere. Sorry, we're getting on to hard secularization, but it is the thing that I think here in Northern Ireland would be very foolish to imagine it's not around the corner, because I believe it probably is around the corner. Thought I'd hear myself saying here in Northern Ireland, but there you go. Why are you not sitting with your wife?
There was no seat beside her. I was concerned about your comment early on about the clergy who were troubled about wearing their collars in public. I haven't found that. I wear my collar in Dundalk. I've worn it in Drogheda, in Dublin, in other towns around the country. When I would be at a funeral or something, I would walk the street from my car with the collar. And the only comments I get is, hello, Father. Sometimes a smile, and sometimes have you the price of a cup of coffee.
Yeah. Any more comments or suggestions? We've all been very clerical so far. So that's okay. Can I just again say thank you very much indeed for coming along tonight. I'm not saying make sure you come back next week, but I do think that there are, they say, these two aspects of secularization. The soft one we've been talking about, which is there, it is insidious, it is something in fact that can simply we are seeing. I would be fascinated to see our census returns for 2016, how they will relate to 2013. Now they're being done in a slightly different way, in that I think I'm right in saying the four Sundays of November are being counted, which will have a slight probably effect on some numbers, in that probably, Dean, it'll mean that the numbers in the cathedral will be massive, because the Remembrance Day service for our Mass in the cathedral, which means we'll have Presbyterians and we'll have Methodists and we'll have Roman Catholics and we'll have all kinds of people crowding into the cathedral. So it'll look as if the cathedral is packed to the gunwales every week. But I'm not sure how we quite manage those kind of situations, because last Sunday evening I was preaching in Birr in County Offaly for a big celebration service there, and they weren't sure whether they should do the census or not, because they said actually their normal congregation had about 40 or 50, but there were about 250 people there, very few of whom were probably Church of Ireland, relatively speaking, and should they count all of them as being part of the congregation? I don't think they did, but I think they should have, actually. I think it would have been a great boost to them if they'd done so. But I will be interested, on a serious note, I'll be interested to see how 2016 does actually compare with 2013. Are we going to see again a slide? Are we going to see things levelling out? But as I say, don't be under any illusion that this is our mission field. Secularisation, a secularised society, is our place of mission. Thank you very much indeed. Let's have a moment in quiet. I imagine, Neville, there will be a cup of tea at the end. It looked as if there were cups. Again, our thanks to Maureen and those who have prepared it for us. But let's have a moment in quiet, and then we will offer what we have heard and what we've considered to God. Lord God, we thank you for our time together, for the fellowship that we have shared. We ask now that you will give us the courage as we leave this place to be evangelists for the faith, to be ready to take up opportunities to explain our faith, to take up opportunities to listen to the stories of others, not with condemnation, but with love and with compassion, that through our interaction with them, we may be enabled to bring something of the love of God into their lives, of a sense of purpose into their lives, and above all, the sense that they are loved by us and by the God who created them in Jesus Christ. Amen.
Yes, there's a cup of tea. If you can stay, please do. If you want to chat, please do. And the Archbishop's here. If you want to come up and talk to him, or indeed Terry, come up. You're very, very welcome to do that. And just spend 10 or 15 minutes, or as long as you want. But the tea will be coming. I know the boilers are on. Just give them a couple of minutes and the tea will be there. I don't know whether any of you might have heard Stephen Nolan a few weeks ago. I shared this with a congregation as part of a sermon one Sunday morning there a few weeks back. And I was in the car, and usually my radio's in the car, and it's usually always on, and it's usually Radio Ulster that I'm listening to, so I'm just in and out of the car. No, they are Radio Ulster. He's trying to imagine listening. Anyway, I won't go there. And I was listening to Stephen Nolan, and there was a lady who came on. I don't know what the conversation was, I don't know the context before it, but I just got into the car, and there was a lady come on. Now she by the sound of her voice, she was an elderly lady. And in very, very simple terms, and very, very graciously, she told about Jesus and what Jesus meant to her. And she'd just been through a very serious operation, and she was home from hospital. And she spoke that she knew that even going into the theatre for the operation, she wasn't on her own, that Jesus was with her. And she was so simple. And I was waiting on Stephen Nolan breaking in. And he didn't. And when she finished, there was a silence. There was a pregnant silence. And for one of the very few times that I've heard him, the mask seemed to drop. And what he said was, "I wish I could believe like that." The mask, for me, the mask came down. And you saw something of the real Stephen Nolan. "I wish I could believe like that." And just as you were speaking to the NR space, I just wonder how many people are out there that would share that same thought. "I wish I could believe like that." Seriously, yeah. "I wish I could believe like that." So please, if you can stay, we'd love you to stay. The tea will be coming along in a moment, and please just enjoy a few minutes of fellowship and we'll get it organized. And if you want to speak to the Archbishop, he's here. If you want to speak to Terry, please, he's here.